This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on professional negligence. I am joined by barrister Sarah Ibrahim from Three Hare Courts Chambers in London. Sarah regularly undertakes professional negligence claims, including cases that are pursued against a wide range of legal professionals. Sarah is ranked in the Legal 500 for her work in this field. Thank you very much for joining us, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I will say it again, because I said it earlier. Here we are recording remotely during this most unfortunate situation that the world finds itself in during the pandemic. So professional negligence law. Let's talk about this, Sarah. So what do we mean by professional negligence? What types of professions could this relate to?
Well, the first thing to say is it's a civil liability. So it's for a breach of a duty of care owed by a professional, usually to their client. So this can cover a whole range of professionals. You're looking at surveyors, financial advisors, architects, lawyers. It can include medical professionals, but that's normally referred to as clinical negligence. So I'm going to leave that to one side for today. But you're probably best off thinking about individuals who have professional qualifications, and there normally is going to be a professional body that regulates them.
Good. That's very, very clear. So it's where a professional fails to perform their responsibilities to the required standard, I guess, to the client, to the end user.
That's right.
Perfect. Okay. So what is the difference, would you say, between a professional negligence claim and a service complaint? So, for example, when is something a possible service claim rather than a complaint?
I think this is such an important question, actually, because the distinguishing feature of any action for professional negligence is you've normally suffered a financial loss. So that is what turns it into a professional negligence complaint.
So professional, yes. So there we go. That's very key, isn't it? If you suffered a financial loss, then we're talking about a professional negligence claim. Is that the only factor that counts, would you say?
I think it's the main factor. With service complaints, you're normally looking about disagreements over fees. You may not have understood the advice which has been given to you. There could be delays in things like correspondence, but you're not looking at actually having suffered a loss. So typically, a professional is going to set out for you, hopefully in writing, to make it nice and clear what their terms and conditions are, what they're meant to be doing for you and what they're not.
Yes. So let's just make it absolutely clear. A service complaint versus a professional negligence complaint. Service complaint is them not delivering on time. Professional negligence claim, you're saying, is when there's a financial loss.
That's right. And it can get a bit more complex because sometimes if people delay for a period of time, then it takes you from having a complaint into a potential claim.
Yes. No, I get that. That's very clear, actually. I mean, a duty of care, a legal duty of care is required by a professional to act within a certain standard with certain skills while dealing with their clients. And in most cases, people hopefully should have a written contract with the professional that they're doing business with. And the duties that the professional will owe to the client should be listed in that contract, in that agreement of some sort. And it could be as simple as on a sort of an attachment to the back of a receipt or something like that, where people have their terms and conditions, where companies and individuals, professionals have their T's and C's. So what are the most common factors, would you say, that can be relevant to deciding what the standards of care should be
from a professional? And what are the key principles, the outlining principles, when we talk about duty of care?
So a duty of care, to take it right back to the most simplistic principle, is the legal standard a professional is expected to perform their responsibilities to. So when you're deciding what that duty of care extends to, as you've already said, it's normally set out in a letter, and that letter could explain what the scope of work is. So there can be disagreements between a client and a professional. What is the professional meant to be doing for you? A good practice from a professional, so they set it down in writing. This is what I've agreed to do for you. This is what may fall outside my area of expertise, because even if you're a professional, there are limits to what you know and limits as to what you should be advising or helping on.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So the principle of duty of care is that you have an obligation to avoid acts or omissions which could reasonably be foreseen to injure or harm other people. So, you know, that's part of it as well, isn't it? So as well as saying, here's what I'm going to do, and potentially here's what I'm not going to do, if it does go to that as far as that, the actions of that professional shouldn't be ones to injure or harm people or create financial loss as a result of their actions.
That's absolutely correct. And the important thing is what the parties had in their mind when they entered into that contract, when the professional agreed to do work. So what the client will have told the professional about either their level of knowledge about what's going on in terms of, say, I'm buying a house and I'm a first-time buyer, then the professional would need to know that information, because they may have to advise me in a slightly different way from if they're advising somebody who has got a lot of properties, maybe is running a buy-to-let business, and therefore may not need the same, just to use a kind of layman's terms, kind of hand-holding through the process.
Yes, yes, no, indeed. So if someone thinks, I think I might have a professional negligence claim, what's the first thing that they should do? And I know that we do try and encourage people to say, right, well, bring, first thing you should do is try to resolve it where you are with the person that you think you've suffered professional negligence with, and say, look, I'm not happy, here's my formal complaint. And hopefully they could provide a resolution at that stage without it becoming litigious or contentious and needing legal advice. But so say someone says they've done that, they've gone through the channels of the service provider, and they're not satisfied with the final response of what that service provider says they can do. What can somebody do next?
Well, this may surprise you coming from a lawyer, but I'm going to say get legal advice as soon as possible.
Yes.
I know people think that lawyers always encourage litigation, but when it comes to professional negligence claims, if you've done the sensible steps, which you've set out, you've tried to resolve it, you've used a complaints procedure, it is now time to go get legal help. And that is easier than people think. So there are so many resources available online, which is particularly important in the middle of a pandemic. And you're probably thinking to yourself, I can't walk down my high street, I can't drop into a solicitor, I can't have a consultation. Have a look at the Professional Negligence Lawyers Association. They've got a special search option on their website, so you can actually look for people who specialise in professional negligence. And they've even got a section which lets you know which of those lawyers are working during the pandemic, which I imagine is all of them. Because well, whatever you may be saying, we're all trying to say we're working normally. So please do get legal assistance.
No, that's very, very helpful, actually. And I think that's really key guidance, because some professional negligence claim will have different time limitations to others, and the law does have time limitations in it. And I know I've explained this, we've spoken about this on different podcasts, but to briefly mention it again, time limitation is what the law sets out, is the time period in which you can make a claim. So if you're out of that time period, you may not be able to bring a claim. So I think you know, what you're saying is spot on. Get legal advice, at least the headlines of your legal advice, quickly, to ensure that you're within the time limitations that you need to be, if you do feel that legal advice is the only way you can potentially resolve a professional negligence that you have potentially suffered. So, okay, so let's talk about if you're the professional. So if a former client has a potential claim against you, what should you do? I mean, you're here, you are. It could have been more than likely completely unintentional that your actions has caused this these losses to a potential client. What can you do as a professional who's got a potential negligence claim against them?
Well, the first thing is you ought to have professional indemnity insurance. So one of the first things you should be doing is getting on the phone or emailing that insurer. And you shouldn't be waiting for there to be a formal letter or a pre-action letter telling you that there's going to be a claim. If you're concerned, that is what your insurance is there for. Get in touch with them. They deal with these claims on a very regular basis. They are there to help you. I think sometimes I've seen with professionals, there's a temptation to be like an ostrich. Sit your head in the sand, hope it will go away. That is the last thing you should be doing. Get in touch with that indemnity insurer.
That's a key message, Sarah. A very key message. Do not be an ostrich. Do not bury your head in the pond, in the sand, or in anywhere. And I think you're absolutely right, because some professionals have this sort of view that if they call the insurers, then the insurers may start putting up the insurance policy the following year, or they may not offer them the insurance policy the following year, and they almost fear calling the insurers. But that's got to be absolutely right. You know, the earlier you call your insurers and make them aware, the more assistance you could potentially get earlier on, and the right assistance earlier on, rather than waiting to be bombarded by a potential legal letters and pre-action letters of claim if you are in dispute with a client that's potentially trying to bring a professional negligence claim against you. So yes, I think the ostrich is definitely a sound bit of advice there. So the next thing that people say is, well, will I have to go to court? And I know we've got podcasts on mediation, but let's talk about alternative dispute resolution and mediation. What can we offer on that? What can we say on that?
I'm so glad you asked this question, because I think for this area of law in particular, it's such a good way of resolving disputes. If you wouldn't mind indulging me, there are two that I want to talk about in particular.
Yes, please.
First is mediation. So that's the most commonly used at the moment in my experience with professional negligence. You have a mediator, often but not always a lawyer, and they try and assist the parties to find a resolution. So they often will literally shuttle between the two rooms, and they will try and resolve the issues which are barriers to any potential claim being solved.
And I have to say that mediation, even if they're not a lawyer, a qualified mediator is skilled to try and get parties to settle. And yes. And yes, I think in just expanding a little bit further with the two rooms, I mean, mediation, I have seen it work very, very effectively. So a mediation would work where effectively you are there in one room with your advisors, the other side is there in another room with their advisors, and the mediator would go between the two rooms and say, right, where can we find that happy medium to try and resolve this matter before it needs to go further and lots more money, lots more time needs to be spent, and it can be very distressful. Litigation, I don't think I've met somebody that thinks litigation is fun. So it's a very effective way of trying to resolve a dispute very early on before it does go into, do I have to get into a court? Okay.
And absolutely, because I think people lose sight of what they want. When you draw your battle lines, which tends to happen in litigation, you stop thinking about what do I actually want out of this claim. And mediation is a really good way of drawing your focus back to that. And my clients, and I've acted for both sides, tend to really like the process and find it does bring that resolution they want. But if I could touch on the second thing, which is adjudication. So the Professional Negligence Bar Association now runs their own adjudication scheme. Also, all details are online, and it goes to a lot of the points that you've been talking about. It tries to be quick, it tries to be economic, all those things that protracted litigation often isn't.
And that was set up in 2019, wasn't it, Sarah?
That's
the Professional Negligence Bar Association.
Yeah, there was a very, very little pilot a bit earlier, but the scheme was properly expanded in 2019. And I think the important distinguishing factor between a mediation and an arbitration, so an adjudication, is the adjudication is binding. So with a mediation, you may have a rather what may feel like a fruitless day where you don't come to a resolution, but there isn't that adjudication between the claim and the defendant at the end, or defendants, where there is a binding decision that's been made.
That's very interesting. And I think just to clarify that even further, so in a mediation, when you come to an agreement, hopefully the mediator will type up the agreement that you've come to, and you will all, parties will all get a copy. And the hope is that you will step away from that day and that matter will be resolved. Nobody will turn around and say, actually, I've changed my mind, or I've now gone away and spoken to so-and-so and so-and-so, and these are not favourable terms for me to settle on, and I don't want to do that. So they can still walk away from a mediation and renege from what has been agreed. Whereas what we're saying is, in an adjudication, it's legally binding. So an adjudicator will prepare the details of the agreement, and neither party can turn around and say, well, I've changed my mind, or I've spoken to so-and-so, or these aren't favourable terms. That's what we're saying, isn't it?
It is. There are always legal loopholes, but I would like to sound a note of caution to that, because when you're starting to unpick an adjudicator's decision, it's costly, you're in court, you've kind of undone the whole good of going to adjudication in the first place.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think that the adjudication gives that additional peace of mind to people, that if they do agree and settle a dispute in an adjudication, that legally binding point, just like you say, it's costly to then try and unravel that, and hopefully it will encourage people to stick to the agreements that they have made. I have to say, I haven't actually been involved in any mediations where people have walked away and changed their minds and reneged from it, I have to say. So that's probably a good record so far, based on the mediations that we've been involved in. So, OK, we've got time to discuss one more question, Sarah, if you would please. So if somebody says, I think there has been professional negligence here, what can we say about how you can go about proving that there has been a breach of duty of care? What would be sort of some of the key points that will be required to prove that that's actually happened and taken place?
Well, in terms of the ingredients of a professional negligence claim, it's good to think of them as having five basic ingredients. The first one is duty of care, which we've discussed. The second one is you've got to show that there's been a breach, because it's not just about whether the professional has a duty, you've got to show they've breached that. And then whether the claims really tend to get slightly more contentious. Three, what we call factual causation. But for that act of negligence, would you have suffered a loss? And then for something which is called legal causation or remoteness, would the loss have actually been in the minds of the parties at all? If it's something that's so out there, neither of you were thinking about, it's unlikely to be covered. And five, you've got to actually have suffered loss. And that can often surprise people. But if you haven't got a loss, there's no real point putting yourself through the stresses of the litigation of a professional negligence claim.
That's really helpful, Sarah, because I have to say, in America, in the US, and we do have our second biggest listeners in America, actually, and they have a completely different set of rules to how they judge professional negligence. And the UK, I have to say, I do get people more often than not saying, does my loss have to have been financial? Because this has happened and that has happened, and I've lost days of sleep over this, you know, because their actions have caused this sort of stress. And it does have to show that there has been an actual loss. So it is surprising, I think, because in America you can, you know, there are grounds for professional negligence claims, in my view, that relate to the stresses that you've lived and you know, everything else around that the UK law doesn't deal with. But it's been great. It's been really good speaking to you, Sarah. Time does fly. Thank you very much for your time today. This has been a really, really good podcast that I know we're going to do a part two for. So don't go anywhere too quickly. So thank you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable.
Good. And what I will say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.
Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes.